Hello, everybody. I sense the room getting quiet, so that'll be my cue to get started here. My name is Darren Incrivaya, and I'm really pleased to see so many smiling faces here for our panel today, A Just Transition for Oil Towns. So if you are not trying to attend this panel, now is your final chance to leave. I will be barring the doors otherwise. Like I said, my name is Darren. I'm a freelance science journalist. And I co-organized this panel with my colleague, Madeline Ostrander, and we have a great group of panelists here to chat with you, and I won't blather on too long, so I will just introduce them briefly and then let them introduce themselves to you. So first, of course, is Madeline Ostrander, a journalist to the stars. Then we have Marisol Cantu, David Bond, and Shamar Pitts at the end there, and I believe they're all set up to give you an introduction into who they are, the communities they're coming from, and then after they introduce themselves, we'll do some question and answer. So Adam, I'll let you get off and start.
Yeah, thanks so much, Darren. So I am going to try to be brief, but I just wanted to do a little bit of stage setting about what this panel is and why three folks are gathered for you. So just a little bit about me. I'm a climate journalist. I'm currently a fellow in the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT. But I'm normally based in Seattle, Washington, and I write about a range of climate justice and climate adaptation and climate science issues, but a lot of my work has been focused on how local communities deal with both climate impacts and deal with the fossil fuel industry. And in the process of that coverage, a lot of the communities I've written about are frontline communities, communities at the edge of fossil fuel facilities or at the forefront of climate impacts, especially on the West Coast. And one of the places I've spent the most time in is Richmond, California, which is built around a massive Chevron refinery, which is one of the largest greenhouse gas emitters on the West Coast. And Richmond appeared in my book, which is up here in dressed in green, about how communities are confronting the climate crisis at home. And over the years that I've been reporting in Richmond, I've watched the community's perception around the oil refinery really evolve. And so when I first started reporting there, there was a lot of frustration about air quality and about the company's relationship to the community and the political power it exerted on the community. But over the years, the conversation has really shifted dramatically to a farther-reaching discussion about just transition and a recognition that this refinery will likely close one day if California is going to meet its climate goals. And does the community have the power to shape what that looks like? And it's actually kind of unusual for community to be asking that question even right now and to assert that they might have a voice over that. And it led me to thinking about the question more broadly and why are more places asking these questions? And how are we going to think ahead about the kinds of transitions that need to be made around massive oil facilities like this specifically? And that's really part of a larger set of nationally important and internationally important questions that reverberate here in Philadelphia, of course, where, as most of you know, and some of you got a firsthand tour of it yesterday, there's a massive refinery site that closed after an explosion, and it's now going through redevelopment. In conversations, and I didn't put my slides in the most amazing order here, but I'm going to I'm just going to mention that there's been a lot of amazing coverage regionally and nationally of what's been happening with Philadelphia Oil Refinery, and it fits in a lot with what I'm trying to say, and this is a not even slightly comprehensive collection of a few of them, but I just wanted to give a sort of shout out and acknowledgement to that coverage, but also to say that the questions that are being asked about this refinery, about the three communities that are up here, are going to be relevant to a lot of communities around the country. And a lot of the conversations about just transition have focused on where workers who leave the fossil fuel industry going to go. And there's some really good reasons for focusing on that question. The idea of just transition actually comes out of the labor movement and about this issue of what happens to people's jobs. But there are a lot of other big questions about how transitions affect communities like around oil and gas sites, how challenging those transitions will be, what kind of long-term planning they're going to require. I'll give you my other couple slides about Richmond just for some context, but Marisol is going to tell us all about Richmond too. This is the Chevron refinery on the left after a major 2012 refinery fire that I think really changed the conversation in the community. And on the right is a community group called Urban Tilth, which has been doing a lot of work on urban gardening and trying to re-envision what Richmond could become. And Marisol is also part of a larger coalition of groups that are having that conversation. And here is the Richmond Refinery, just for a visual of what a refinery looks like, the massive landscape, really, of oil processing. There's a lot of different perspectives on the future of the refining industry, but the Union of Concerned Scientists predicts that roughly half of all U.S. oil refineries will be decommissioned by 2040 and half of the remaining by 2050. And the consulting company McKinsey has a different, which, you know, works with the oil and gas industry, has a somewhat different analysis, but even they say that between 5 and 41% of the refining capacity in North America could shrink by 2040. And also the global refining industry could either retain its size or shrink by as much as 75% by 2040. So there's a lot of big questions to ask about what happens to these places. And I forgot to mention it when I had the slide up, but I did a longer piece in The Nation that was sort of a follow-up to the book about conversations happening in Richmond about the labor industry and the community and what kind of vision they might form together about just transition. But some of the questions that I think are important, these are also not comprehensive, but that I think journalists could think about are: how and when does a refinery close? Who decides when and what it will become? Does the community that lives beside it get a voice in that? What happens to tax revenue and sometimes significant philanthropy that's provided by the oil industry to the community around it, often money that the community is very dependent upon? What's the role of labor unions in a conversation about just transition in a refinery town? And can fence line communities and unions find common ground? And Marisol can speak about that as well, and these other folks as well. A refinery is a kind of a landscape, as I mentioned, and the Philadelphia refinery site, for instance, is about two central parks. So it's, you know, they're big places. They're very polluted. They have decades of stuff in the soil. So how and when does that landscape get cleaned up? And according to what standards? And who pays for it? Sometimes multiple parties are responsible here in Philadelphia. What is owed to the communities that have lived with the pollution of our fossil fuel economy for multiple generations? And is there a kind of climate debt or some kind of reparations? And what would those look like? And then how does one bring the benefits of the green economy to these communities? There are some provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act offering tax credits for private companies that build clean energy projects in energy communities. But I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions about how those benefits come to these places. So that's a whole bunch of thoughts and ideas. And Darren and I brought together these three great speakers from three different communities that have been thinking a lot about these questions, that are in various stages of refineries that are closing, or, you know, they're thinking about whether they might close, or they're thinking about transition. And so we wanted to give them the opportunity to share their stories with you. So that's kind of a big overview. And with that, I'm going to pass it off to Marisol.
Hi. Hopefully you can hear me okay. Okay, awesome. My name is Marisol Cantu. I'm a third generation Richmond resident. Well, and I think we'll pull up my slide. I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you. I'm part of an organization. The larger coalition is Our Power Richmond, but I am also a steering committee member for the Richmond Progressive Alliance that takes political power from corporations like Chevron that have polluted our politics in Richmond for decades and puts it in the hands of the people. And so, wrong way. I come to this work humbly. I come to this work for the generations before me, for my ancestors, and also for the generations coming after me. I was exposed to the refinery at a really young age and didn't understand it. I saw my baby brother in and out of the hospital on breathing treatments the first year of his life. His first birthday, he was spent in an incubator. I couldn't hold his hand. I didn't fully understand what that meant. I just understood that he couldn't breathe, and I could. And I just didn't understand the complexities or consequences of the refinery that I was living next to. And when my brother, who is now a full adult, decided to have a child, the first question he asked was, "So when will I know? When can we test if the baby has asthma?" And this is extremely common. It's not if the child would have asthma, it's when. When can we start testing? And thank goodness, my nephew Gianni, his birthday is today, 3 years old, and was not born with asthma or any type of breathing treatment or breathing issues. And so that was my first exposure to the refinery, although we didn't fully understand it. Later on, I was about 10 years old. I'm sorry, about 5 years old. In 1993, there was a massive explosion of sulfuric acid from a train going into the refinery. And a lot of people don't understand. It's the industry that we're talking about, not one set of buildings. So there's a whole bunch of other businesses that provide the chemicals needed to refine crude oil. And that sent plumes of smoke to the hospital, and there was a class action lawsuit. I didn't know about this. I was five, but I remember standing in a line of hundreds of people, and I just didn't understand why were we in line? And I kept on saying, "Why are we in this long line, Mom?" And all she kept on saying was, "We have to get our check." And I thought, "A check? Why are we getting a check?" And she said, "Well, there was an explosion. We have to get a check." Again, I didn't understand that that was a refinery at 5 years old. I just understood that we needed to get our check. At 18, I remember all of my friends and I talked a lot about 18 money. We called it 1800. This was the amount of money from the class action lawsuit that we actually got. At 18 years old, we got $1,800. And a lot of us were so excited. We're a predominantly Black and Brown community. We were excited to buy shoes or a cell phone or some type of $500 crazy car that we could afford. Whatever it was, we were so excited. And we didn't realize it was flood money. It was polluter money. And that is what we're still dealing with today. And so I went on a venture, and I'll go through these slides really, really quickly, through life, kind of questioning what it was to be a frontline community member. And I joined the Richmond Progressive Alliance and took on a project, the Listening Project, deep listening. I know many journalists and Americans generally think about this as active listening. I really want us to push harder talking about deep listening. And we listened to the community and we asked questions to understand what it would be to live in a fossil-free Richmond. And this was generally our framework. I'll move again quickly through these. But we started asking questions to our community. We surveyed over 500 people, and we just wanted to understand their understanding. And they had, many of our community members, like Madeline said, we had a huge understanding of the role that Chevron plays in environmental justice and climate justice and sea level rise and flood issues and water issues. I remember we called each other chemical babies. Like, that was a thing. It wasn't like crack babies from the 80s. We were chemical babies because we were exposed to all of the chemicals in the refinery. And that was kind of normal and a running joke in the community. We also wanted to understand our health burdens. The 500 people that we focused on the areas very explicitly around the we focus on areas that are explicitly around the front line of Chevron, and about half of the residents that we surveyed had themselves or a family member that had a chronic respiratory illness. And in Richmond, one in four children have asthma. It is normal for teachers to have inhalers in the classroom. It is normal for them to have to buy their own air filtration systems to put into the classrooms. Our current mayor, Eduardo Martinez, was a teacher. We interviewed him, and he created an asthma club for children that couldn't meet the PE standards because they couldn't breathe when they were running. And he had to create a different program with the parents to make sure that they were meeting the goals of our standard PE. And so I would like to show you from all of the interviews and the surveys that we did, and then I'll kind of end on this, that we interviewed over 50 residents and we talked to labor and we did a episode in Spanish and podcasts of all things. I'm probably the only millennial that doesn't listen to podcasts and yet had to create a podcast because young people said we should create a podcast. So we created a teaser to the podcast. It's online. And what we did was unique is we wove in all of the voices of our community around specific topics. So if it was on the asthma club or growing up as a young person, or if it was on labor, or if it was on buying us out with polluter money, payout money, we also included that. So here is the teaser. I'm used to earthquakes. I'm from California, so it's nothing. But I just wanted... don't know if that was. Yes, this is.
Sorry, I want to keep everyone.
I think we're okay. I think we can keep talking about transit.
Ask that we, if you want to, I don't know, look up the earthquake or talk about the earthquake, to leave. Marisol, thank you. I'll pass it off to David to continue our great discussion here. Sorry about the earthquake.
Do you have that? Did you?
I said something.
Oh,
there we go.
Good morning, everybody. That was a very curious experience. Everything moving a little bit. My name is David Bond. I'm an anthropologist. I'm not an environmental journalist, and I'm not a member of a community on the front line. But I've worked with the community living on a front line since 2010 in one way or another. And that's the community of St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And I'll walk us through that case a little bit. I think there's some particularities of that situation, but also a lot of insights that are of a sort of a general conversation we're having today. And the thing that I'm sort of most struck by right now is how obvious the case is that this refinery has to be closed and how much enthusiasm there is from the community of St. Croix to do just that. And at the exact same time, there's no regulatory, legal, or even plausible way to start that process. So you have, for maybe the first time, huge enthusiasm from the community to close the refinery down and move the island away from oil, and no place to take the first step. And every time the community tries, it gets smacked back down by regulatory processes, courts, and the governor, who insists that this is the only economy of the island, in ways that make that transition impossible. And we'll sort of go through a little bit of the case and maybe come back to that bigger point. St. Croix, this is from Inside Climate News. They had a great graphic, so I borrowed it. St. Croix is in the U.S. Virgin Islands. At one point, the refinery there became the world's largest, founded in 1966 by Leon Hess. I consider it through and through a colonial refinery, and it's colonial because its location in the U.S. territory exempted it from federal labor law, tax structures, and environmental protections. The most valuable thing about the refinery in St. Croix was its impunity to compliance, that it always stood just outside the law. I've often said that the refinery in St. Croix has always been close enough for the U.S. to gain the benefit and just far enough to avoid any responsibility for the mess. And this is how the refinery became the world's largest refinery. And then for many of the decades of its operation, was the largest refinery in the Western Hemisphere and then the second refinery in the U.S. At one point at its peak was processing about 650,000 barrels of oil a day, which is roughly give or take about 5% of domestic U.S. consumption. Huge, huge refinery in a small, small place. And it's precisely for how hard it was to see that significance in a small territory of the U.S. that allowed it to operate with impunity to so much labor law, environmental law, which is why we're in the problem we are now. There's a brief history with in 2011 of mandating a little over $700 million in pollution updates, and then the refinery closing down to avoid doing just that. Under Trump, Trump found a magic wand that waved away all history of liability and rushed to operate, reopen this refinery as central to American energy dominance, overrode all sort of existing industry standard practices for reopening, even the regulatory process for certifying and permitting a new refinery, to rush this refinery back into operation. Predictably, it was a disaster. Early on, these are some of the local headlines. Steam and oil plume causes odor at Lime Tree Refinery. This is what residents were seeing and living day to day. The picture here is from a daycare, and the woman had to rush her children into the daycare, put tape over all of the cracks on the window because that cloud of petrochemicals was coming through the windows under the door and causing the children to start coughing and being unable to breathe. These were daily occurrences that were happening on the island. That slide didn't quite work. What did the governor say?
I think it's a manhole. I think there's an uncovered manhole somewhere that's causing these odors. And we've tried to identify that manhole, and we think we have it under control. The refinery themselves, you can't quite see, but the refinery is putting out daily press releases saying everything's fine. All emissions are below all health standards. Completely false. It turns out much later they weren't even operating fence line monitoring equipment. They were just sort of issuing assurances that had no basis in fact. The Virgin Islands Health Department said no record of anyone seeking medical assistance. Trust me, if there was a health issue, we would see the evidence, and we're not seeing any evidence. Not true. We did a survey that documented 65 people that we found that sought medical assistance during these episodes, about 4 months when the refinery was back in operation. We ran a health survey. I partnered with three local communities to try to document what was going on and sort of make that accessible to journalists and policymakers and the community itself. So many of the people we talked to thought they were going crazy. They thought they had an issue that they thought they were all alone at. And one of the things we tried to do was sort of make that accessible to the community. We went around, talked to folks, documented it all. This is the sort of the heat map we put on where people experience real health impacts from the refinery. About 20,000 people live downwind of this refinery. Most of them people of color, most of them poor and working class. And their impacts were sort of completely invisible for about 4 months. We also, this slide didn't come through. All of it's on the website, bennington.edu/limetree. So anyone can go and look at sort of how we compiled that. These are the quotes we tried to pull up of the enthusiasm and sense of outrage from the community that oil needs to end on this island, that oil has always operated with a complete impunity towards any sense of responsibility to the people or the place, and that the end of that regime has come, and an overwhelming response from the people to move beyond oil. At the same time, I mean, these are some of the quotes from the people. St. Croix has had an oil economy for long enough. The refinery, after causing all of this harm, filed for bankruptcy right after we put out our survey results, expressly to avoid environmental liability. And they filed for bankruptcy in the Houston court, which is very, you know, friendly. And the bankruptcy court opened the hearings by saying, let's save an oil refinery. And of course, the injuries to health was the dead last on the debts worth repaying in that. This is not the first time the refinery has filed for bankruptcy, and there's a long history here. The governor of the Virgin Islands now pitching reopening the oil refinery as essential to environmental justice. Environmental justice costs a lot, as does climate investing in climate resiliency. How are we going to pay for that? I have an idea. We reopen the oil refinery to invest in climate resiliency and to provide funds adequate to environmental justice. EPA has been generally fairly good, but there's no process within EPA to face up to the sheer absurdity of this situation and do what the community is asking, which is to provide a pathway forward to close the refinery and build an economy different away from oil. People on one side, institutions on the other. The people know what we should do, as does all the climate science. Rapid decarbonization is required. And we have enthusiasm for that project in some of these communities. And yet no institutional way to begin to build out that project in a real and substantial way. Here's the pitch. They're trying to reopen the refinery now. And one of the pitches for the investors is a world-class energy storage and logistics hub. And again, pitching it as you can sort of, you know, baptized of all of its history, and coming in as a gleaming new, exciting investment opportunity. And here's some of the folks that I've been working with still trying to come together to put together a substantial plan for economic sovereignty and for the people themselves to begin to chart their own, future, and what that consists of.
Pass it over to Shamar Pitts.
Oh, thank you. So just from looking at both of these presentations, right, it's like deja vu, right? Right here in Philadelphia with the former PES oil refinery that Philly Thrive had to go to war with and get it shut down, right? It's the same thing. It's the same exact thing. So I liken it to what Maricel said, right? When she said, you know, we grew up as chemical babies, right? And it's similar to crack. It is similar to crack. You can make money hand over fist, but it kills people, right? And this is what the fossil fuel industry does. Excuse me. It kills people, right? And they make money hand over fist, and they can care less about the carnage that they leave behind. Because in my community, the oil refinery was just there, and its mere existence was like a sleeping giant, like you didn't even pay it any attention, right? So much so that we never even thought about the money that an oil refinery makes or any of those things, right? And in Philadelphia, you don't have to pay taxes if you're a big corporation like that. You don't pay a dime, not a zero. Keystone Opportunity Zone. You don't have to pay taxes. And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to, you know, give a couple kickbacks to the community. Well, we got zero in my community from an oil refinery that was right in our backyard. Literally, in the high school that I went to, it was crumbling around us. We didn't have after-school programs. We didn't have robust sports teams and stuff like that. We didn't have good books. Sometimes the heat didn't work. Air conditioning, we just thought you're not supposed to have that. That wasn't even a thought, right? Why? No money in the budget. But if you look right out of the window out of our school, like if you look and you see that building right across from here, that's how we could see the oil refinery making billions and billions of dollars while the school crumbling around us. We don't have no money for books. Sometimes teachers don't even come. We last in everything. We last when the Philadelphia Inquirer put out them scores on the test scores of the schools of the city, my schools is always bottom, last. Not next to last, last. Why? Because of no investment. Oil refinery right across the street making billions. And it was crazy because how I got involved with Philly Thrive was just like, I still feel like, dang, they pulled the wool over your eyes. You should have knew, right? That's how I felt when Philly Thrive came to the park in my neighborhood and they had a table just like this with statistics and graphics of what the oil refinery was doing to our community. And I remember having a conversation with my dad maybe a few years before that, wondering why in every household, on every street in our neighborhood, somebody has cancer, asthma, heart disease, some kind of sickness related to breathing mostly, and we couldn't figure out why. And I was, when Philly Thrive was there, I was like, how did I look past the oil refinery that was sitting right there in plain sight? I felt like a fool. I was like, wow. But that was the beginning of the end of the oil refinery, because from that day on, it was on. It was on. And the first campaign that we launched against the oil refinery was Pay Up EES. And just like David just said, a regular strategic move is file for bankruptcy. We can't pay anything. We ain't got no money. File for bankruptcy, right? And that wasn't the first time that happened, right? And just like she was saying about the check that y'all got, the $1,800, right? We didn't get no check. We never got any money for the way they killed everybody in our community. They never gave us anything, right? They had explosions, and we just had to deal with the smell, and we just had to deal with it. They never gave us money. They gave people hush-up money, don't complain anymore, right? But no class action lawsuits or anything like that. And it was, is devastating to our community, because what happens is when an organization like Philly Thrive comes to Philadelphia, the founders of it being college students that's not from Philadelphia, and they come in our neighborhood, they come in a predominantly black neighborhood. And when you come in Philadelphia, the politics of Philadelphia is a world of its own. And the politicians, you know, they immediately, a smear campaign is in effect. And they say, don't trust them white people. They don't care nothing about black people. What they want in your neighborhood, they're trying to get something from you. These are the things that they tried to spread within our community. And it worked. For some people, it worked, right? But me being who I am, right, I know better than that. I know for a fact that a white person is not better than a black person. A black person is not better than a white person, right? I know for a fact that it all, anybody being better than the next person is how good of a person you are, not your race, color, or creed, or religion, or anything like that. So they couldn't get me with that one, right? And it was just so mad, because I have credibility in my community. I have a lot of credibility, and I'm well-respected. And people know I stand on truth. They know that. So me being a part of Philly Thrive was like, well, wow. If he's a part of the organization, it has to have some kind of substance, or he wouldn't even be involved with it, right? So to endure that smear campaign, and just think, the oil company, they got millions and millions of dollars to spend, right? And our politicians, they are in control of a lot of people. They give grants to people in our neighborhood, because our community is suffer from disinvestment tremendously over time, right? We one of the most disinvested communities you can think of in Philadelphia, right? So them little grants that they give out, man, people, man, they hang on them like they hanging on for their life. So when them politicians tell them, don't mess with Philly Thrive, that's they follow them marching orders, right? And my message to all of everybody in Philly Thrive was, let's just do the work. The work will speak for itself. You don't got to worry about what people say about us. We don't need credibility, right? And we was working hard to make PES have to pay up, but they went into bankruptcy. So what happened was Brilliance and Philly Thrive in the life and the living of Alexa Ross. She's not here. Boy, I wish she was here. She had to take a break. She's on sabbatical right now. But the brilliance of her, this young lady, was just tremendous and on display at all times, right? So, okay, they're in bankruptcy. Guess what? Let's go to the politicians. We want legislation passed to say whoever purchases this from bankruptcy, it can't be an oil company. It has to be transition because we got to get away from fossil fuels anyway to save the planet. We need to start working on a Green New Deal right now anyway. So let's make this transition right now. Let's start in Philadelphia right now with the biggest oil refinery on the East Coast. So let's start that way. Man, we went out. We blocked off Market Street down City Hall. We blocked off the route, the rotunda and everything. They were so mad at us. We marched to the mayor's office and demanded a meeting with the mayor. And we got that meeting. And when we went in that meeting, the mayor was, how dare you come in here for a meeting, right? These are the things that we were up against. We went to city council and testified at the hearings where they had people coming from all over the country just to put on a show to act like they're considering shutting down the oil refinery. And, you know, we considering transitioning away from fossil fuels, and we wanted to be a just transition. So they put on them shows and have everybody Skyping from all over the world. And when their whole intention is to keep it open, right? Because I went to my city councilman that I knew personally, that I grew up, I went to elementary school with, and we had a meeting with him. And he was, I said, you know, it's killing us. It's killing us. We have the statistics. University of Penn did a study. Drexel did a study. Temple University did a study. Pick one. And I got all a stack of obituaries right here. Where you want? We got all the proof right here. Shut it down. Support the legislation. Well, you know, there's a lot of jobs over there. Just like he said, just like David said, there's the jobs and the economy and all the money that it brings to the city. And I'm like, but it's killing us. And they don't allow anybody in my community to work in the oil refinery. Black people don't get jobs over the oil refinery. We have to watch as all the people get in their cars and get on 95 and all their plates is Delaware and all of that that work over the oil refinery, right? So we don't benefit. All we get is death. So while all that is going on, we can't get our legislators to support legislation. Nobody wants to support legislation, but it's in bankruptcy court. So bankruptcy court is really out of your jurisdiction. That's federal. So we went to the bankruptcy court in Manhattan, and we went to the bankruptcy court in Delaware. And in the midst of all of this fighting, the oil refinery had a massive explosion in the middle of bankruptcy proceedings and everything. And that was like the straw that broke the camel's back. They was like, yeah, we just going to close until we sell it, you know, because that's, you know, we done, you know what I mean? So, and then you had oil companies lined up around the block to buy it. And you had one company, Hilco, that wasn't an oil company. And we were lobbying hard at bankruptcy court for Hilco Redevelopment Partners to win the bid for this oil refinery. And nobody... It seemed like everybody was against us, and we didn't know what the bankruptcy court judge was going to say. And we thought that, you know what I mean, he was going to rule in the favor of big money. But lo and behold, he saw it our way, and he said it has to be shut down. Hilco's going to win this bid, and it was just tremendous. We was just so overjoyed. It was tremendous. But then you get back to now. How are you going to repair this? What about reparations? How are we going to repair this harm that's been done to our community for over 150 years, generation after generation, with compounded with lack of investment in education? So you have people, you have a community of people raised up in a school system that produces ignorance. Because you leave school not knowing. You leave school without an education. So you are ignorant. And by you being cut off from education, you automatically cut off from the economics of the city. You don't have the wherewithal to even know what step do you take to become economically substantiated in your community. You don't know the first step to take because you haven't been taught. And it's not your fault, right? This is not by accident that we were raised upon ignorance, right? And that we were raised right by an oil refinery that was keeping us sick, right? So how do you repair that? So what Philly Thrive has done is we took up the task of being responsible for negotiating a community benefit agreement so that this being 2%, this oil refinery took up 2% of Philadelphia's land, is bigger than Center City. And you can fit Center City in there almost twice, right? And that's how big this oil refinery was. And everybody that went there, y'all saw how big that oil refinery is. And so my idea, and I'm just a regular person, I don't have a college degree or anything like that, but, you know, I got common sense. So I'm saying that this being the largest redevelopment in the history of Philadelphia, you can change all of those bad things that disinvestment did to us for all of those years. You can change that right now. We have an opportunity right now. Let's change that. Let's do it correctly. But in Philadelphia, the politics is what they are, right? Hilco can come in and say, you know, we get a Keystone Opportunity Zone tax break. And we the best of friends with Hilco, but I don't care if it was my mother. We not advocating for a tax break for anybody when we got to pay taxes. You got to pay. Yeah, we friends, and we love you to death, but you got to pay. We need the revenue right now in our community. We suffering. We need that revenue. You have to pay. So that was strike one against us, right? And, of course, our politicians, they ready to sign right off on it. But we, Alexa and Rachel and other than them, I can't remember everybody's name, but the brilliance, right, coming to life. Okay, the school district has to sign off on this. We just had a crisis in the schools where you had it was a heat wave, and they had to close the schools because you couldn't send the kids to school in this heat wave, and there's no air conditioning. Why is no air conditioning? There's no money in the budget. School district, look, you go the money for the budget right there. Don't give them that tax break. That's the air conditioner money right there. You could buy air conditioners tomorrow for the whole school district. They said, yeah, we're not signing it. That's the first time in the history of this city that that tax break ain't get signed. And they looked at Philly. I thought they was going to just lock us all up and throw us in jail and throw away the key. The way they looked, if looks could kill, oh, my God, they was mad at us. This has never, who they think they are? They stopped the $1 billion deal going down, and they going to stop the tax break? This ain't never happened before. They went to the school district and said, man, if y'all don't sign that paper, listen, don't play around. The school district's, okay, we'll sign it. We'll sign it. They signed it, right? But that was it for Philly Thrive. That was it. We was done. If they could just throw us overboard, we'd be drowned, right? So now he'll go like, you know, we going to negotiate the CBA. So, you know, when we sitting in the park that I met, ironically enough, that I met Philly Thriving, same part, Hilco come with a CBA, right? Sign this. Well, let me see what that say. Okay, they turkeys for the holidays, coats, back to school book bags, scholarships for community college. Oh, that's nice. Workforce development and training and all. Okay, that's nice stuff, right? That's nice. But yes.
I want to pass over a question soon, so.
Okay, I'll wrap up. I'll wrap right up. So he said, no, we want to write some things on there. I want fossil fuel free construction over there. No fossil fuel infrastructure. So EGW and ECO, the electric company and the gas company in Pennsylvania, you know, we rich in gas and all that stuff. So they was like, no, y'all can't do that. And so that's where the fight started. And now they was like, we don't want to negotiate a CBA with Philly Thrive. We'll negotiate a CBA with anybody in a city except Philly Thrive. So we had to shut them down a few times and protests and stuff like that. And, you know, now we got a parallel process. We still get to negotiate while the rest of the community advisory panel get to negotiate a CBA also. So that's where we at now. And it's a long, long, long story. I could go on forever, but like you said, he wanted to open it up for questions. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
I want to turn it over to all of you folks to get your questions. I see hands raising already. Hold on, I'm not ready for hands. But first, I just want to remind everyone, if you were at the session this morning, you know SEJ's question asking policy. Journalists, first, please, and identify yourself when you ask your question. No making speeches. Get to the point. Ask what your question is, please. And I'm going to make a new rule right now. No questions about the earthquake. It's a hoax. Okay, we got our answer. So we can go ahead and get those hands back up. I saw over here first, and then we'll go to feedback there.
I'm Ruth Dussault with Bay City News, and I appreciate your statements, and I appreciate your statements. And sadly, it's the same all over the planet. Wherever you see a point of extraction, it's surrounded by poverty.
Yeah.
My question is for Marisol and Madeline. First of all, Marisol, when you did your deep listening, what did they tell you they wanted instead of a refinery? And Madeline, do you have statistics on the amount of revenues? Is there an average amount of revenue that cities would lose, or jobs? Is there an average?
I can speak to both for Richmond in particular. So Richmond, the Richmond Refinery, I'll go to the first one, second one. Richmond Refinery employs 1,500 people. Most of them are United Steelworker, our local five. I was on the line with many of them. I think that is something unique about Richmond, is that we are looking at a just transition with community and workers at the helm. We are interested in jobs because Chevron's narrative is to divide and conquer. And when we have workers and community united against a billion-dollar corporation, we know that we're stronger. The taxes that come into our general fund are 30% of our city budget. And we also have, after our 2012 fire, which sent 15,000 people into the hospital, we negotiated a CBA, and I have a different take on CBAs. I don't really ask for CBAs. That is nothing that I have seen, the over-reliance on CBAs, because it perpetuates a cycle of us being constantly dependent on a refinery in particular. And so we have scholarships. We have nonprofits that are built off of Chevron's money, small businesses. And so what happens in our community is when we talk about a just transition, a lot of people say, but what about the small businesses? What about the students? We need that. And so we're really looking at a just transition that supports clean, green, just energy, offshore wind, solar power. We're looking at revitalizing our port with pure electrification of the wharf. That is a project that's happening. There is a way forward in a green economy. There is a way forward with our super progressive majority on council right now has a green blue new deal with USW Local 5 workers, environmental justice advocates at the helm creating that green blue new deal right now, and a workforce development plan for all of the workers and community members, because we are barred from a lot of the 5% of our workers live in Richmond. I know most of them. Why would you live so close to a refinery when you're dying early, when you have cancer, all of the same that we're having? They're living even worse. When we interviewed land cleanup, pure 100% land cleanup, restoration of the land, I learned that there was not a pure land cleanup here. Cement was put on Philadelphia's refinery. That is the nightmare that I am working to fight against. We would love to give this back to the original stewardess, the Socorrite Land Trust in the Bay Area. The Ohlone people are the ones that have stewarded the land, and it 100% needs to be given back to the indigenous people. The refinery covers a third of our entire city. It covers a third of our shoreline. And so we would like to have it. Other people have definitely talked about reparations. We have an initiative that we're building out called the Right to Return. Many of our Black and Brown communities have been gentrified out with the tech boom. We would like to have a right to return and have Black and Brown community members be able to buy homes in the area. We're also putting anti-displacement zones and ordinances in the city of Richmond. And you know, when we asked the youth, they talked about skate parks. They talked about swimming pools. They talked about everything that we don't have, after school programs. And right now, the mayor and the Richmond Progressive Alliance are researching a way to make them pay now before they leave. We are not going to end up fighting for scraps and crumbs afterwards. They need to pay now. And so, but if they leave, it would be a devastation at this point because of the local economy. So we also have to diversify, and we need to make them pay for that green, just economy.
Thank you. In answer to the other question, I don't have statistics from local areas across the country about this, but I know that it's a common issue that I think sometimes gets overlooked in conversations about the impact of these facilities, that there's a lot of discussion about jobs, but there's a huge amount of tax revenue that some communities are dependent upon from oil and gas. In Richmond, the Other and Belonging Institute, which is at UC Berkeley, has done some really good analysis and research on this. And Other and Belonging was also involved in the Richmond Listing Project that Marisol mentioned. Another place this is maybe a little bit tangential, but another place that I've written about and given some thought to this is on the North Slope of Alaska, where you have a situation where like 90% of the local revenue for all the programs comes from oil and gas. And just, I think that the way that shifts the conversation about how to make transitions or whether people even want to talk about them sometimes gets overlooked. So.
Yeah, I just wanted to, my name's Brittany Cordera. I'm a state impact reporter in Oklahoma. I work with the NPR member stations there. Of course, in Oklahoma, there's a lot of refineries, but also a lot of vested interest in maintaining refineries and just, you know, communities that are really proud of the oil and gas industry in the state. And so I'm wondering how you go about, balancing the people who are really proud of the industry with the realities of their health, and also the fact that we need to make this transition. You know, how do you balance that?
I feel like you're a good person.
Yeah. So we really need to come to the table together to build relationships, and in particular, build around mutual points of concern, worker safety, community safety, public safety. This is on the mind, the public health. This is on the minds of all workers. They're dying young. Their families are being born with cancer and so forth. It's really difficult, in particular, when you're talking to workers. There are also people in Richmond that love the refinery. The refinery has such a stronghold. They are the good neighbor, which we've all heard of before. But the statistics, the fact finding, I think is really, really critical. Also showing up for them. I showed up on the line at 3 o'clock in the morning with coffee. We organized, environmental justice advocates organized right alongside labor to build a relationship for decades. And so this was really critical for us to be able to come. One of the vice president of USW Local 5 was fired after he stood up against Chevron. And after the strike, he was fired, and our mayor picked him up as a policy director, and he's now the mayor's policy director. This is how we build relationships and trust, because now those workers look to him. He's the one that got out. He's the one that is actually in a safer environment and fighting for environmental justice. And so becoming and finding those mutual points of concern is really critical, and public health and worker rights and worker safety is really important.
I don't know if David or Shamar have thoughts on that as well.
That was a brilliant answer. And, you know, you have to come together. That's the key. And, you know, you have to teach also, you know, because a lot of people don't know. So that's another thing. You have to teach people.
I think I can add just one thing, which is just that when I've interviewed folks, labor leaders, there is, I mean, it depends on where, like who you talk to in the union, but there are certainly people who are thinking about what the, you know, the direction of the industry. And that's been true for a long time. I mean, there's been efforts over the years between the environmental movement and the labor movement to try to build alliances and have discussions about energy transitions and economic transitions. And so, I mean, it's not like unions aren't thinking about this. And so I think, you know, the question is, are people having a conversation together about what the transition can look like? And I think, you know, Marisol's done a great job of trying to facilitate those conversations, but I think they could be happening in a lot of places.
So I'll be there first, and we'll come over here if there's time.
I was just wondering if you guys had any suggested, like, Sam Strong from Public Health Watch, kind of like replicable steps for communities living outside of refineries, because I know the trends of the industries are like, this is kind of, it's not looking good for industry, but, you know, that could be 20 so years later. Are there like steps that you think that communities who want to shut down a refinery, like what are some steps that they could do themselves to hopefully get their own closure or like start that process?
So I would say the first thing you have to do is you have to wake your community up. They have to, you know, understand like what was happening in my community when Philly Thrive came, and with the data, it speaks for itself, you know, is bad. It's a bad thing. No doubt about it. It is an economic driver. But it's bad for the health of the people. But then when you look at the planet, we just can't stand it. You know what I mean? That point has to be made that as long as this is here, we're going in the wrong direction, and we won't last much longer as a planet if we go this route. So we have to start thinking about a just transition so that people who do lose their jobs, they can go into another industry, and we have to look at, you know, things, you know, things to put in its place, you know, like wind and solar power and things like that. So we have to have alternatives, and those things have to be carefully thought out. But, You got to get that information to your community as a whole, because the first thing the industry does is try to put the workers against the activists. So you got to bridge that gap from the very beginning.
Very quickly, in my work with St. Croix, folks on St. Croix, I've been struck by how powerful documenting the history of the refinery was and making that history accessible to the community. And it provided a place where everybody could say, oh, you know what? I experienced that too. Or, you know what? I had this experience that I had somehow put outside. It was, you know, a gray area, my memory. And all of a sudden it comes back into focus as something that there were problems for a long time. And they only became thinkable very recently. And I've just been struck by how powerful documenting the history of the plant has been. I also think it's a question that could come right back to you all of what can journalists do. And to me, there's at least one very powerful thing is sort of, you know, rejecting what C. Wright Mills, sociologist, once called crackpot realism. And it's the sense that comes out of a lot of agencies or courts or folks. We just have to be realistic here. We just have to look, there's no real possibility of change. We just have to be realistic. And for the communities, that's absurd on its face. And I think there has to be a way to tell the story that demonstrates the absurdities of what sounds reasonable in a federal agency when it's brought into the community that's actually living that experience day in and day out.
I'm Catherine Boudreau with Business Insider, and I had a question just about how, like, this transition, you know, it's probably maybe not going to be seamless from closing a refinery closing to then ushering in cleaner industry. So, how do you bridge that gap, especially in terms of like tax revenue, workforce? Is it just like the polluter pays? Is that like, how do you ensure there's enough money there? How do you, you know, ensure the workforce has new jobs? And is that, how do you usher in that transition? It's not going to be seamless, but the trade-offs, yeah.
So not only are we looking at the bond measure that would make Chevron pay for future transition, we're also working with labor to ensure that labor is finding and paying for the pathways and training that 1,500 workers will need. And if there is a severance or a time for adjustment, that they're able to do that. We've also looked at training workers to decommission the refinery itself so that could be another phase, because we have to take down the entire. I heard that there was a contractor that came in really quickly. I don't know if it was a union contract, but saying that, hey, you're going to have a transition period of another 2 years decommissioning this entire refinery. That is something that workers, that labor can actually pay for that training and ensure that then the decommissioning happens with the local union. And then post that, they would be able to pay for the training for the green, blue, new jobs that they are going to see. So there's a lot more research that does need to be done. I think one of the biggest issues is that I have not seen, and I've researched just transition as much as I could, I have not seen a just transition in reality. So we're creating it as we speak, and I've learned so much from my colleagues on what to do and what not to do in particular. So I think it's an uncharted world that we're all going into together.
Time for one more question.
I'm Mike Piskowski. I work for Inside Climate News. I live in El Paso, Texas. There's a Marathon refinery. We don't have studies. We don't have data. Like, our state regulator is notoriously bad at like regulating air emissions. So do you know of any like examples of citizen science or like where reporters or people have gone to like document that themselves? Because I know people in the neighborhood are concerned, but they just don't have like that information at hand yet.
I can quickly touch. A lot of our community air monitoring systems are coming out of universities. So looking at partnerships with the universities is really critical. Young scientists that are interested in putting up the air monitors. Also, one of the issues that I have with community air monitoring is that it again overburdens the community that's already living with the effects. And now that we have to become scientists to just be able to understand this. And then you monitor for the sake of monitoring, but then there's no enforcement. And so it's really unfortunate that there's a marathon in the Bay Area as well. And they were just hit with a huge fine for spilling oil for the last 20 years unregulated, even in the area. And so even in the progressive Bay Area, we're not doing as good. And I could imagine in kind of in Texas, the regulation is not there. California does have the Air Resources Board and air management districts that I know many other states don't have. And so it is incumbent on the community members to actually be able to. I know a mentee of mine that created their own air monitors and started putting them around homes. They're, I think they cost about $300, and they work with the local lab to create those. And so, and he's 18 years old in Richmond. So there's ways to do it.
I say universities can be great partners for this. I mean, there's a number of folks that have tried to partner with communities to document exactly what's going on. In St. Croix, Bennington College, where I work, we partner with the community organizations that do that, and universities for the moment have some independence from those political pressures. Open question of what happens going forward, but for right now, we do have some independence. But I will say, I mean, I think echoing Marisol's point, that when we launched the health survey in St. Croix, we started off by saying it's embarrassing that it's come to this. It's an embarrassment that the community has to now document what's been done to it. This should be the responsibility of federal agents, local territorial government groups. You know, there are people whose task it is, whose job it is to do just this. And it's from the incompetence and refusal of those folks to step up that the community has to stand up.
Unfortunately, we have to wrap up there. I want to encourage all of you to keep the conversation going, please, and continue thinking about how to cover these issues. And I want to ask all of us to thank our wonderful panel once again.